Right, I think this is audio number 4, and we have one more little lemma to prove now, the subgroup criterion. So this is about having a subset of a group, and you want to check whether it's a subgroup, and you don't want to go through all the axioms. Then the subgroup criterion is something like a shortcut. And the good thing is that, and again, this is why I show this result to you, if you have seen one or two results of this flavor, then you might be able to come up with your own. So maybe in the future, if you see interesting structures and you are interested in substructures, then maybe you will have your own idea for a substructure criterion that will save you work, just because you have learned to think in this algebraic way about these things. Hopefully, this is what will happen. Let's see. So now, we are going to prove 2.1. I'm quite impressed by this really whiteboard. It was just adding lots of water to it, and then it's fine. And I hope it will not do this squeeching sound all the time. That would be mildly annoying. Let's check the statement, what it says exactly. Because we had the discussion about if or if and only if before. And in this lemma, it actually says, if and only if. This means that we have a proof now where we have to go in two directions. One direction is, we start with a subset that actually is a subgroup already, so we know that. And then we want to prove that the properties that I call subgroup 1 and subgroup 2 are satisfied. And then we also need to go backwards, start with the properties, and prove that such a subset is actually a subgroup. Two ways in the proof. And I start with one way, so I start with U being a subgroup. First, let U be a subgroup, so I'm doing the edge here, so denote subgroup, less than. It looks as if we don't have that very much work to do, right? Because we already proved that the element 1G, the neutral element from G, is contained in the subgroup, so SG1 is already done. Which was the lemma before. What about the next property? It says that if we take two elements from U, A and B, then it is true that one of them, let's say A, times the inverse of the other one, let's say B inverse, is also still in U. Now, how can we prove this? By just using that U is a subgroup? Well, let's check. Being a subgroup is a powerful thing. For example, B is in U, so it must have an inverse in U, and it's the inverse we already know, so it's B inverse, which is now also in U. But it's also closed under the binary operation, which means that if we have A and B inverse, and they are both in U, then their product must be in U as well. So everything is fine. It's basically just staring at it for 10 seconds and everything is clear. Do I see disagreement? It's okay. It's not a rhetorical question. Please disagree with me, if you like. I see thumbs up. Good. So I'm going to write one or two short sentences, and then one direction is fine. A, B are in U, then B inverse is in U, again by lemma 1, and then A times B inverse is in U because U is a subgroup. That was easy. When one direction of the proof is this easy, then I often get suspicious and I think, oh, okay, all the work must be in the other direction. Sometimes it is. Conversely, suppose that U is a subset, so I'm doing the round sign, and it's such that these two properties, SG1 and SG2, hold. By the way, what about the light situation? Is it getting too dark? Should I switch on some light? Make it the spots for the whiteboard. Is this a little better?
Yes.
Okay.
That's
good. I take any excuse to play with the controls. Right. Now I would like to prove that U is a subgroup, so I need to check now. Unfortunately, I need to check G1 up to G4 for the subset U. Or do I? Let's think about this. Do I really need to check all of them? Let's write down those that are okay. Which ones are maybe okay? What do you think?
G2 is okay.
G2 is okay because it's inherited from the big universe. Yes, G2 is okay. Something else? Okay?
We also proved G3, proved in the sense that 1G is equal to 1U.
That was for subgroups and U is not a subgroup.
Right.
Ah, careful.
Right.
But I like your thinking. I like how you try and save us work. Let's see, maybe we can still save work there, because SG1 says that 1G is in U, so it should behave like a neutral element in U, right? So that's a candidate. Okay, I think it saves us work, because we already have a candidate for G3. But for G4, I don't have an immediate good idea, and also for G1, I don't have an immediate good idea. So there's the work. G2 is fine, G3 is almost fine. Okay. Mm-hmm. Let's do it this way. G2 gets a check, and G3 almost. 1G is in U by SG1. And let's just check that it really behaves the way it should, because what we need for U to be a subgroup is an element that behaves neutrally for all elements in U. So let's take a little U in big U and just check, just to be on the safe side. So if little U is in big U, then what happens if I multiply from the right, because the axiom says the element comes from the right, if I multiply from the right by 1G, then we get U, because 1G is neutral in all of G. So in particular, it's neutral for the elements in U. So everything is fine. It's in U, it behaves like a neutral element should, so everything is fine. I'm not going to add anything to this. Now, I'm wondering which way around we should do the other two. Let's say we take, I think it might be even G4, which is easier to do first. Let's see, I might regret this in 2 seconds, but I think we can prove G4 first. Let's take any element U in U. Then I take this in the role of B in property SG2, and I take the neutral element in the role of A. So taking 1G as A and U as B in property SG2, we see that. Okay, let's implement the letters. So if 1G is A, and if U is B, then the product that we get there is 1G times little u inverse. And the property says that this product is in U. I leave a little space here on purpose. So now we have 1G times U inverse is in U. A times B inverse. But with our properties from the big group G, this element here is just U inverse. Which means that the inverse of little u that we have in the universe G is already contained in U, and therefore it is an inverse for little u in big U, which means that G4 is fine. And that was a bit easier than expected, maybe. We just really use the two properties. We use them combined because I have been using that one G is in U, otherwise this little trick doesn't work.
Yeah, and we also use that one G, U inverse belongs to U, that takes the property that one is satisfied, G1 is satisfied.
Absolutely, exactly. Thank you. Yeah, it's like millimeter steps, but we have to be careful. And now all that's left is G1. Which is weird, because it looks as if G1 should be automatically true, but it's not, because we're not claiming that the product of two elements is again in U. We're claiming that the product of one element with the inverse of the other is in U, which is not exactly the same. But maybe you can see a trick, just like now. Maybe you can see a similar trick that we can use here in order to get what we need. What do you think? Do you have an idea? Let me make a little, how do I call this? So in my lectures, and then in German I say, wir machen einen kleinen Schmierzettel an der Tafel. So it would be like a little scribble board on the blackboard. So just a little room where we just scribble and we don't really take it seriously and it can be messy. Let's have a little messy place. Yes, I like that. Let's have a little messy place on the whiteboard. A messy place, maybe in green. I thought I had green. Here. Ha. Little messy place here in the corner. If it's too small, let me know. But I like little messy corners on the board. So the idea would be this. We have x and y and u, and we need x times y and u. But this is not the right format. This is not what we have. Somehow we need to manipulate it so that it looks like an SG2. Sorry. So x is fine, but somehow the y is the problem. The y is always the problem. What do we do? Any little trick that we have seen? Let me ask the question a little bit differently. Is it possible to write y as the inverse of something so that it would be closer to what we're looking at in SG2? What would that look like? So we're searching for y equal to something inverse. No idea? It's fine, it's late. It's okay. But when I tell you, you will all go, oh, of course. Let's see. Y is in U, and we already established G4, which means that we have Y inverse. And Y is the same as Y inverse inverse. Oh, that was it. Okay, let's write this down properly. Yeah, it is actually, maybe it's that. We take X and Y and U. Then y inverse is in u, c above, so this is g4, which we already did. And y is the same as y inverse. Inverse, but this is not automatic, this was a lemma, and I forgot the number. Let me check. I think it was lemma number 1.2, part A. The inverse of the inverse is the element itself. And then SG2 gives x times y is the same as x times y inverse. Inverse, so y inverse is the element that I'm applying SG2 to, and therefore it's contained in U. this product. So this was a little bit sneaky around the corner, but that's how we did it. And that was the subgroup criterion, and I hope that you will find it very useful. Actually, we can apply it maybe to one or two of the examples that we saw earlier, where we had structures that were to be preserved, and we gave some intuitive arguments why there should be subgroups coming from that, and now we can make this more precise. Let's see. First, I want to wait for a bit for you to finish and then to maybe ask some questions about it. Tell me your questions. What is on your mind? Should we practice using this in one or two examples, maybe? What do you think? Let's say... now I have all the foam here. You told me. I apologize to those listening to the audio, but this is how I work. My students know this, so they have all these audios, and it's always like there will be weird noises, in particular when I find animals on the board or something. Right. Let's flip again. Ready? Can I flip? Surprisingly hard. Okay, I want this. Some examples. Let's be really, really courageous and let's say that G is the group of all permutations of the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and U is the set of rotations of, and I'm just going to draw a picture, I take the regular 5 one, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And we discussed before how I should be more specific when I say rotations in order for those to be well-defined, clearly defined maps. So let's say I take the counterclockwise rotations, as always. I'm always counterclockwise. And I think it was you who said earlier that in the setup with the regular n1, we can always classify these rotations. So here n would be 5. So we have 360 degrees divided by 5. That's our basis angle, so to speak, which means that now we have this basis rotation around the center of the 5 one, which means that 1 goes to 2, 2 goes to 3, blah, 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 blah. And you can already see how there is a very intuitive way to write these rotations in terms of permutations as we did before. Let me just suggest to you how you might do this. The rotation I just talked about, where everything just goes one place further counterclockwise, could be written in our permutation group notation as the cycle 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We close the bracket, 5 goes to 1, which is consistent with what we're doing here. Excellent. So we don't need new notation. So this would be, or it could denote the rotation with 72 degrees. And then if you like, you can practice using this notation for the other rotations counterclockwise. There are 5 of them. And I claim that the set of these rotations is a subgroup. And let's prove this using the subgroup criterion. Instead of checking all the axioms, let's just check what we need to check with this lemma that we have just proven. SG1. Oh, the binary operation, of course. Now we can see that I already consider you advanced. I didn't even tell you what the binary operation is because I thought everyone already knows it's composition of maps. Good, and I see nodding and smiling. SG1. What is, let's just recall, what is the neutral element in this big group G? What was that again? Lots of things. Be louder. Tell me loudly.
No change from the existing sequence.
No change from the existing sequence? What?
Yeah.
Yeah? Other names for that, maybe?
Identity.
The identity map. Thank you. We do nothing. Okay, 1G is the identity map on the set 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Is this a rotation of our 5-gon? Yes. How many degrees?
Zero
or 360, depending on whether you want to have the ungon sum action or not. You just have to decide so you don't have two different names for the same map. I don't care. It's definitely in U. It's definitely one of these rotations. Excellent. And now SD2, which means that we take two rotations, that alpha, beta in U. Now, how can we find notation that somehow tells us something about the rotations and how they work? How can we describe what alpha does and what beta does? Do you have any idea? I'm just asking because we need beta inverse. So I need a way to describe what beta does so I can describe what the inverse does. At the moment I have no idea. I only know that it rotates something. Do you have an idea? How would you describe it? Yeah?
If we associate beta with some angle, multiple of 70.
That's a good idea.
Degrees, then the inverse of beta would be the rotation in the other clockwise direction.
Mm-hmm.
Or also we could also express it with the angle.
With the angles, we could do that. So we need a multiple of 72 degrees. Let's maybe just say that k beta is such that beta rotates with k beta times 72 degrees. So we give a number to each rotation and the number tells us with what we need to multiply 72 degrees so we get the right angle. That's one way to do notation. There are lots of other ways. As you saw before, we can also take such a cycle and write the rotation as such a cycle. The problem is that if I don't know what beta does, I don't know which way around to write the numbers. So I only know that such a representation exists. But now you already had an idea how we can write the inverse of beta. So tell me again, what is beta inverse?
Depending on whether we want negative angles, we could express it with the negative of k beta times 72 degrees.
Mm-hmm. Or? If we want to stay counterclockwise?
2 pi minus k.
Then multiply, like multiples of like several rotations.
We just need to agree on something. So, for example, if k beta was 2, so we would have 2 times 72 degrees, how would I know the corresponding k that belongs to beta inverse?
2 pi minus k beta.
Exactly, or in our case, 5 minus the number that we chose. Yes. So it depends. It really depends on the language that you think in, which is why I'm not telling you how to do it, I'm just agreeing on one way to do it, and then later for your applications, you just choose the notation that is good for you. Mm-hmm. Now I want to take the composition of alpha and beta inverse. So maybe I need the number that belongs to alpha. But we introduce notation now, so k alpha can be the number that belongs to alpha. And now alpha composed with beta inverse, and I should write, maybe I should not write a circle, I should just write dot, because dot is the general name for the binary operation that we're using right now. But let me have a comment arrow like this, where I say composition of maps, so that we don't forget. And if I compose alpha and beta inverse, then What is this map? Can you describe to me what it does? Because I have to decide whether it's in you or not. How do I do that? It is, I mean, all these maps here give us a permutation of the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's the big universe. The question is, will this be a rotation of our 5 gon? And if it is, how can we describe it?
We could call this new rotation gamma, and then say k gamma is k alpha plus 5 minus k.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let me just take this, so you will have to tell me again in 10 seconds, but let me just write it in this way. Now alpha times theta inverse is a rotation with angle, what did you say again?
K alpha.
K alpha.
Plus 5 minus k beta.
Plus 5 minus k beta. Yeah. We just use the rules, how we, and I think we did this earlier, we discussed it briefly, how you can compose several rotations and how you just add the angles. And here we need this again, this principle. Yes. If things get weird, then we just calculate mod 5. I'm sure this is something that you have seen, that we can simplify notation by doing that, that we don't have to think about the exact numbers and whether something gets negative or whatever. But this is how we can see that we again get a rotation. If we apply alpha, then we have a rotation and we have this angle, k alpha times 72 degrees, and then we apply another rotation and again we know the angle and then we know that we just need to add them. In particular, what we get is again a rotation. We have all the information we need. This element is in U. In particular, alpha times theta inverse is in U, and then the subgroup criterion tells us, and we did not need to check all the axioms, just these little calculations here, and we know that we have a subgroup. And depending on your context, such a group of permutations that leaves some structure invariant might already be all you need. Maybe you don't need the big group. Maybe this is sufficient. There was another comment I had in my mind. I have to think about it for a moment. There was something. Ah, yes. Mm-hmm. Careful with types of maps and thinking that composing such maps again gives you such a map. Warning, warning, warning. In red letters and blinking. And think about it until tomorrow, and then either you can tell me an example or maybe we can discuss an example together. If you take reflections, then you cannot argue in the same way. So just think about it. Take an object, such a regular n-gon. Think about reflections. We need this tomorrow anyway, so it's good if you think about rotations and reflections. Think about reflections and think about what happens if you take two reflections and you apply them one after the other. Is it true that the result is a reflection? Always? Sometimes? Never? What's going on? So can we translate what we did here for rotations to reflections? So this would be an interesting question to think about. Also, good preparation for tomorrow. Because now I think I am almost ready to give you a preview for tomorrow. Almost. There's one more lemma that I would like to discuss with you. It's an application of the subgroup criterion. Namely,
I have a question to...
Oh, yes, please. Yes, yes.
SG2.
Yes.
It seems very complicated to check this instead of just checking that for every element we have an inverse in U.
Mm-hmm.
That also be...
It might not be enough. Yeah. Actually, this is a good question because there are two obvious simplifications that we could do. One is the one you just said. So instead of this product, we just ask that inverses are in there. And another obvious simplification would be that instead of this weird product, we just ask that the product of A and B is in there. And both of them are not sufficient in general. So it depends. In some contexts with stronger restrictions, this would be sufficient, but in general, it's not. And it's a nice exercise to think about counterexamples. Yeah. Thank you for this question. Mm-hmm. You can replace SG1. So SG1 can be replaced by asking that the subset is non-empty. That is sufficient. But you cannot, in general at least, you cannot replace SG2 by asking just for inverses or just for being closed under the operation. Right. So one more lemma to prove before we can start and get excited about what we do tomorrow. And this lemma is an application of the subgroup criterion. And again, it's useful if you want to construct new subgroups or if you want to check whether something is a subgroup rather than going through all the axioms. And again, it's a very natural construction. So you have a group and you have several subgroups. I'm phrasing it for an arbitrary number. We are going to prove it for two because this is enough. You have an arbitrary number of subgroups and the intersection of all of these is again a subgroup, which means that you will have simplified ways to either see that something is a subgroup or to construct new ones just by applying this. And the proof is really easy. Intersection, just to recall who is not immediately clear on what the intersection of sets is. Okay, you've all seen this at some point, good. Then we can prove lemma 2. We are going to start with our group G and then we take subgroups. And are there two interesting ways to go now? I'm going to ask you what you prefer. The two ways I could go now are the very simple case, just two subgroups, and then you believe me that this can be extended to arbitrarily many, or I do the extreme general case of arbitrarily many, and I set up notation for that. It's both fine, and the arguments are almost exactly the same. It's just a matter of how this is written down, so you decide. Who wants to have the very simple basis case for just two subgroups? Who wants to have the general case with arbitrarily many? Okay, we do that. So what does arbitrarily many mean? I mean,
No.
That's what you think, right? So 1, 2, 3, many, it means for any natural number n, you take as many. Yeah, but that's only countably many. You could have incountably many subgroups. So that's even more fun. Yeah, so when I say general, I mean really general. So I take an index set, and I have no idea what the set is. It could be incountable. And there are examples like this, where you have something in the real numbers, and then you construct for every real number a subgroup of a particular type, and then you have incountably many, and that's fine. I would step away a little bit from this. It's very infinite. But this is why we need lemmas like this for this very general context, and why I phrased it in this very general context. So let I be an index set. No restrictions. And then I talk about a collection of subgroups because I don't even know whether it's a set. Things could be really weird. And let curly U be a collection of subgroups of G. And curly U is indexed by this index set, which means that it's the set of UI, where I and I, and all these should be subgroups of U. Of G. Now, the collection is called curly U, and I'm just writing this so that you see how I write elements of the collection. So I write the elements as U with an index I that comes from the index set, and this is all the generality we might ever need. Okay, now I want to look at the intersection. Let D be the intersection of these UI, where I is an I. And I want to prove that this is a subgroup of G, and I use the subgroup criterion. It's actually very easy. This is the magic of the subgroup criterion. This looks a little bit complicated, but no, it's not, because the subgroup criterion is always so easy to check, or very often very easy to check. In fact, let me think. No, I think I gave you enough little homeworks and exercises to do so that tomorrow we can practice using this a little bit more. We don't have to do this today. Let's stick with D. SG1 says that I need to find the neutral element of G in D. So do you see it? Is it running around there somewhere in this intersection? Yes, do you see it? Why is it there?
Because it proved earlier that IG was, one G was equal to 1U. And each U must have this neutral element.
Ah, okay. So you say that for every index, the neutral element is in UI?
If that's what we kind of proved.
Yeah, okay. And if it's in all of them, then it's also in their intersection, and therefore it's in D. Totally correct. Yeah, I agree. People here agree too? Good. Very good. Mm-hmm. So that was lemma 2.1. That's all fine. For all I and I, lemma 2.1, actually, I believe it was 2.1, says that 1G is in UI, hence it's in the intersection. That's SG1. And now we check SG2. So we take two elements in D. Let A be in D, and again we stare at the situation for a moment and we try to see what's going on. Maybe it's the same lemma, maybe it's another one. Do we have any information about how A and B behave in this intersection D? Again, let's take an index and check, because A and B are in the intersection, so they are in all these UI for all of these indexes. And what do we know about A and B and how they behave in one of these UI?
SG2.
SG2, because it works both ways. So now we use the if and only if. Ha! Ha ha! Here it's really worth doing the extra work. By SG2, we know for all I and I that A times B inverse is in UI. And then it's again in the intersection. And then SG2 the other way around gives the result. Ha! Thus, A times B inverse is in D. And lemma 2.2 gives D is in fact a subgroup of G. Ha. Great. So now we learned a lot about subgroups. I want to make so many comments, but I have to stop myself a little bit.
Why did you call this a collection and not a set?
Because, very strictly speaking, depending on what G is, G might be a really weird infinite group. I can't be sure that if I take such a collection, that this will be a set. So even though I'm writing it here like a set, I would avoid calling it that. It might be something weird, just because infinite sets are weird. Yeah, infinite sets can lead to collections that are not sets, in the sense that you might find something that where you cannot decide whether it's in there or not, and then it's not a set in the sense that we usually talk about sets. Mm-hmm.
So
sets are weird.
So that means if you take a subgroup of G, you may not cannot decide if it's part of this intersection U or not, if it's an element or not. That
could be one of these weird situations. Yeah, that's what I'm thinking of. So it could be one of these paradoxes where you try to define a structure and then you see that for some element for some element or some subset or whatever, it's not clear. You cannot see whether it's in there or not, or both have to hold at the same time or something. Yeah, that would be a situation like that. Yeah. I live in finite group land. These things don't happen there, which is why I'm happy there. But now in this very general context, I just wanted to make sure I'm not writing anything that in a weird situation could be misleading. Mm-hmm. Infinite sets are weird. Has anyone never seen this? Such a weird infinite set situation? Like Russell's paradox? So when we talk about sets and maths, then, well, it depends. If you just start innocently and you want to go somewhere and you don't want to spend all your time talking about sets and logic and so on, then you only talk about sets when it's something that is intuitively well defined, in the sense that you can always tell whether an element is in there or not. So it could be a set of matrices, a set of vectors, a set of maps, a set of numbers, whatever. But if very abstractly you talk about sets, then you could be tempted to define sets with things with weird properties. And for example, you could be tempted to talk about the set, and I'm doing the air parenthesis thing. You could be tempted to talk about the set of sets that contain themselves as an element. And then it would not be clear whether the set contains itself or not. So it would be I think it works both ways. The set of sets that contain themselves as an element or that don't contain themselves as an element. And then you wouldn't know whether this set would contain itself or not. That's Russell's paradox, and there are lots of versions of it. There are also illustrations of it with, what was it like? I think it was a barber who treated all people who did not treat their own beard or something, and then there was the question whether he could treat his own beard or not, something like this. So there are illustrations of that. And it's an illustration of what happens if you just define something and you do not take care of whether this is a property that can be checked properly or whether you run into contradictions. And anything that has to do with self-containment or self-referencing is problematic. Which is why I stay clear from everything there when I talk to my undergrad students. We only use sets that are where everything is intuitively very clear and there are well-defined objects that can be well-distinguished, and it's always clear whether something is in the set or not. So nothing weird happens. Otherwise, you really have to go into the foundations. And it's a bit disturbing that a science such as mathematics, that is so precise all the time, has at its foundation this weird stuff going on with sets. It's a bit disturbing. Right. Anything else before I make some more general comments about subgroups and stuff? Any questions right now on that, on these previous results? Do you want to see some more examples? Anything else we should discuss? Any questions that came up during the arguments?
Yeah. So we know that that since D is a subgroup of G, then it must be also be a set.
Yeah, because it's a subset in particular. Yeah.
So the mm-hmm. intersection of sets must be a set.
Mm-hmm.
But this curly U is
it's a family, it's a collection, it could be something else, something a bit more general. Yeah, yeah. I'm not a set theorist, so I don't know about all the little differences between, so I don't know what proper set theorists mean and how they differentiate between words like class or collection or family or things like that. I have seen the word collection being used a lot in these situations, collection or family or class, when you are not quite when you don't want to talk about sets, so you want to avoid that. For example, I would not talk about the set of all groups because there is no such set. It's not a set. It's a class. It's a collection. It's something else. Mm-hmm. What else? Okay, some motivation how we move on from here. First, where does group theory go, and then where do we go tomorrow? So where group theory goes, once you have that, you can ask yourself about special types of subgroups. For example, earlier today, I think it was you who mentioned the word generator. There are special types of subgroups that come into the world because of just one little element, and you look at this element in the group and you look at all its powers, so you keep multiplying it with itself, and then maybe its inverse shows up at some point. This is what happens in finite groups, or maybe not. Then you also need to put its inverse into the collection, and then at the end you have a nice little subset of your big group that is the so-called cyclic group generated by this one element. These cyclic subgroups occur all over the place. It's very natural. Within such a subgroup, the ordering of the elements doesn't matter. You have the commutative law, and then you can do all sorts of arguments there within such a subgroup, but also with it. Because then the next thing that happens is that you try and understand how subgroups behave with respect to the big group. Now, you can do this in infinite groups, but to make it more interesting and motivate a bit more, I'm going to turn to finite groups now. For example, if you have a group with, let's go to our example with the five numbers, 1 to 5, and the group of all permutations. We know how many there are, it's 5 faculty. We discussed this earlier. Is it possible for this permutation group to have a subgroup that consists of 7 elements? No idea with the knowledge that we have now. If you do a little bit more group theory, then you can immediately say no, without thinking further. There is a very simple reason for that. And once you understand that, then you can ask yourself, so now I have a few ideas how I can immediately rule out particular kinds of potential subgroups, and I can see, no, this can never be a subgroup. But then conversely, if you have a subset that looks like a subgroup from the distance, and the number of elements in there and the structure kind of looks okay, can we prove that this is the subgroup? And if we can't, can we maybe prove that at least if we exchange some elements, we then get a subgroup? So at least the number of elements is possible. So we try to understand substructures, we try to understand subgroups, and we hope that from information from such subgroups, we can get more and more and more information about the big group. So a lot of finite group theory is about starting small, starting with local information, and extending it to get global information about the big group. So that's a big, big, big research branch, and historically a very important branch. And then there is another question, and this, my favorite comparison actually comes from chemistry. So if you are in chemistry, then maybe you ask yourself, what are the most elementary bits that make matter as we know it? So what are the elements? That could be one question. You can also go in the physics direction and ask about atoms and what atoms are made of and so on. But when I talk about chemistry, then I think about the elements. What are the elements? And then how can atoms build up molecules? And if you have a molecule, then you can split it up into atoms, and then you have them. And when you start with a molecule, it's clear what the atoms are. But if you have a pile of atoms, then maybe you can build up lots and lots and lots of different molecules from them, right? Which means that finding all the elements is necessary in order to be for it to be possible to describe all possible molecules. But even then, even if you know all possible types of atoms, maybe you are not yet advanced enough to know all possible molecules, because there are so many different possibilities how they could be built up, which is why there's so much interesting research. And for groups, there is something very similar happening. Because when you have groups and subgroups, then some of these subgroups are special in the sense that they can be used to basically break up the group structure, which means that you can understand the group by looking at it split up in one part that belongs to the subgroup. It needs to be a little bit special for that to work. And then something that we call a section or a factor group And some information from these two pieces will give you information about the whole group. Maybe not everything, but sometimes it's possible to get some information across. Which raises the question, if you do this, if you split a group up in this way, how long can this process go on? At some point, maybe you have bits that cannot be split up anymore. So they would be like atoms, they would be like little building blocks, like the fundamental pieces, and there is nothing smaller. What do they look like? And if you know them, like knowing the elements, knowing the possible atoms, can we somehow find out how molecules can be built? Which means finding the little building blocks of groups. How can we then build up bigger groups? Is there a possibility to find that out? And we actually answered the first question, and it took 120 years, roughly, from it being asked in this way to it being solved. But then the second question is wide open, just like in chemistry, where we still find lots and lots of new molecules and new materials with interesting properties. We also keep finding out more stuff about finite groups, although we now know what the building blocks are. So what we see here now, groups and subgroups, is the beginning. It's like 1 millimeter into a theory that becomes very rich and very widely spread, because there are all these questions and we need to develop the theory further and further in order to be able to ask these questions and then begin to understand how to answer them. It's very rich. What we are going to see here tomorrow is a tiny little portion of that, where I concentrate on groups that preserve some kind of regularity, some kind of symmetry, something. We are going to talk about symmetry groups. In order to motivate that, I have already included some examples today, so I hope that you all feel like you want to come back tomorrow and learn about that. And the principle that I would like to introduce, and there are some exercises that go in that direction, so please feel free to look at all of them, even those that seem a little bit advanced now. I would like to begin to discuss with you how we can understand a group by understanding its elements with minimal information. For example, if we have a graph or an N-gon or some weird structure, and we already saw that in order to understand its symmetry, we don't need the full big permutation group, but maybe something smaller. But now, if we want to describe what such a map does, do we really want to describe every little bit of the structure and where everything gets mapped? That would be really, really annoying after a while. So how minimalistic can we be? Can we describe what such a map does by giving a tiny bit of information, and everything else will become clear from context? And that's why the group concept is so strong, because it means that we can get away with minimal information and everything will be clear from context because we are living in a group. This is a really powerful concept that we're going to explore together tomorrow. So maybe we can have a tiny little peek. Yes.
So you were earlier discussing about these building blocks as like an atom. So how many of these building blocks exist?
Infinitely many, but they come in an organized way. One type of building blocks comes from these permutations. So now for every natural number you have such a set, and then you have a group of permutations. And all these groups of permutations have a subgroup that is only slightly smaller, so to speak, consisting of all the so-called even permutations. If you're interested, I can tell you tomorrow what they are. And these subgroups of even permutations, they are one type of building blocks. So you have infinitely many. And they start being building blocks when we have at least five numbers. So if the number here is five or more, then with this construction, we get one type of building blocks. One type, infinitely many possibilities. Then you have types that come from vector spaces. So you have vector spaces, and sometimes you only look at the spaces, sometimes you have some forms like orthogonality or something going on, and then you look at automorphisms of the spaces, and depending on what type of group you're looking for, you have further restrictions. So the principle is always the same: constraints, more restrictions, you get a more interesting group. So you have several possibilities there, and this gives rise, so you need to do some manipulations for it to become building blocks, but it gives rise to more types of building blocks. And then for many different fields and possible dimensions, you will have these groups. So again, infinitely many, but they are kind of organized in categories. Then you have one tiny, tiny class of building blocks that I should have mentioned first, maybe, because they come as groups that have as their number of elements just a prime number, very tiny. So for example, the group of rotations of a triangle, three elements, and they form such a building block group. It's tiny, and you have the same for all prime numbers. So that's your first series, and it's infinite because there are infinitely many prime numbers. So that's the very, very, very easy one. Then you have these ones from the permutations, then you have the ones from the vector spaces, then you have similar ones that come from combinatorial structures, again, some infinite series, but they are all parameterized. So you can basically say, here's a type, and now you have infinitely many of those, but they have something in common, and we can try and understand the structure a little bit. Finding these series was hard work, and conceptualizing it was hard work, and several other areas of mathematics have given contributions to it, which is why many of these groups have several descriptions in several languages within mathematics. That's fascinating in its own right. And then you have exceptions. So there are five exceptions that have been found quite early on, the five so-called Mathieu groups, five so-called sporadic building block groups that have been found ages ago, and for a long time people thought, oh, these must be the only exceptions and everything else comes in these nice organized series. But no, there are 26 of them. Some of them are gigantic and really interesting, and they have combinatorics associated to them, and there are books, and it's all very interesting. And one of the most fascinating things for me, and it's one of my research projects, is to historically and philosophically understand why at some point group theoretic researchers felt that they have found all the building blocks. Because if you keep looking and if you keep finding new things, how do you know you're done? Well, you need a proof. But it was really hard, and it took a long, long, long time to find such a group. Yeah, so infinitely many, but kind of organized. More questions? Before I get completely carried away, let's have a peek at tomorrow, okay? And then we talk about how tomorrow should be organized.
So, tomorrow I want to talk about symmetry groups. And these little comments here, they correspond to things that I have already discussed with you. Namely, if we have just a set of numbers, then the full permutation group that we have seen now many times, as example, that corresponds to an object with perfect symmetry in the sense that you have no constraints, no restriction. For example, a regular triangle. The triangle is perfect in the sense that it gives no restrictions on the numbers 1, 2, 3. All the permutations can be exhibited as symmetries of the regular triangle. No information is lost. Whereas if you have a square, then already you have enough restrictions, so you get fewer elements than all the permutations. So we have already seen this principle. And if you like, you can tell me some ideas now, but we can also use this to get into the topic tomorrow, depending on your energy level. We have seen now some possibilities how we can break symmetry in the sense that we move away from the set of all permutations to a structure with constraints so that you lose a lot of group elements. And yeah, sorry, group elements, we don't need you anymore. For us, it might actually be good to have a subgroup and to have fewer elements to look at because it might reduce the complexity of the problem we're looking at. Do you have ideas that have not been covered today for such constraints? Have you seen anything, maybe in your work or in talk somewhere, or does anything come to your mind that we have not seen today? I did not hear that.
Thinking space groups.
What is a space group? This is one of these words that I often hear, and I always wonder whether there is a clear definition what it is.
Bunch of symmetry operations restricting like defining the crystal system.
Okay, so it is kind of meant to be a symmetry group of some object?
Of a lattice, that is.
Uh-huh, and is it clearly defined what the lattice is? What is the lattice? Yeah.
The lattice can be in physics it's usually a two-dimensional or three-dimensional object where you have points.
Okay, so we could, for example, take the integers and on the real line and then have the same vertical to it, and then if we want, we could have another line, so it could be an R2 or R3, and we only have integer coefficients.
Yes.
Yeah, okay, I see, yes. And then we would talk about the symmetry group of that.
Okay.
So it would be, how is it meant? Because it is a big difference whether we need to, for example, fix the origin or not. Do we have to fix the origin? Or are we allowed to translate? We're allowed to translate, so we get an infinite group. Ah, okay, so we're in infinite group land.
If you take any crystal which exists on Earth, so you can define those property of crystal by using this 230 space groups, and each space group says that which symmetry element exists in order to define that crystal.
I see.
For example, for a crystal, this translation symmetry always exists. But for example, if it has some mirror symmetry, or it has three-fold symmetry, or does it have screw axis, does it have glide plane? So all of these symmetry elements, they constitute, like if you for a certain crystal, it will have certain of these symmetry elements, and these kind of combination is called a space group. Like one space group will have a certain combination of these symmetry elements. And thus, 230 space group exist. And with these 230 space group, you can define every crystal which exists.
So this is what I would call half theory, half intuition, because you used a lot of words, and some of them are not yet filled with enough content.
Yeah.
But maybe at the end of tomorrow, this will have changed, because maybe we can look at one of these examples, and actually with what I have prepared, we are coming close to that already. Because my goal would be that you can still use this language, but actually knowing what all the words mean and being able to explain with more precision what is going on. Because what you were trying to tell me, the way I understood it, was that somehow all these possible symmetries have several components to them, so they are built up from several group elements that come from categories that you can describe. Maybe there is a translation part, maybe there is a rotation part, maybe there is a reflection part, and everything is somehow built up of that, whatever that means exactly. So we have to find words for that. What exactly does it mean? The way we can approach this is by separating the translation part from everything else. And group theoretically, you can easily do that by saying, we fix a point. As soon as we fix a point, translation is out of the picture. And then in order to understand the local symmetry, you only need to look at symmetries where this one point is fixed. And then you are basically down to things like rotations and reflections. Exactly. Yeah, so all these concepts make total sense. And you can come now from the other way, from formal group theory language. And then in the end, hopefully, both of these will meet. So you can keep your intuition, but some of the words will now have a more precise meaning. It would be great if this is what was happening tomorrow during the day. Hopefully it does.
You can also extend this concept where you have a bigger group, which is maybe like a product of subgroups.
You
have then at each lattice point also like an arrow, a vector, that also can point in some direction.
Yeah.
And we have a spin space group.
So just... So basically what the goal could be, depending on how motivated you are, to find language for these groups where you have a big group where everything lives. So this could be just the group of permutations of all vectors in your vector space or something. So it would be something gigantic, but then you are moving down to a subgroup, therefore we're doing this, that stabilizes a particular structure. So it could be this lattice structure that needs to be stabilized, or maybe it has to respect something like spins or directions or whatever. But you can write this down as a proper definition, and then you actually know what you're looking at. And the next question is, how do you describe the elements in that group? And then maybe they have parameters, like do they have a translation part, do they have a rotation part, blah, blah, blah. But this is the next step. First, there is this understanding of what they are built up from. And yes, it's true that sometimes you can write groups as products of subgroups. This is not always possible. And the product of subgroups is not always a subgroup, so we have to be careful. But in these situations, very often, this is how it works. And then you can basically try and find a foundation and then build from there and then describe the group elements. We can try and do a little bit of that tomorrow, but I think we will only be able to dip our toes into that. The principle, however, how to approach this and how to describe elements of the group with minimal information, this will definitely be very central tomorrow in the lectures when we describe symmetry groups.
What is the element of the space group? Matrices?
That's just a representation of the map. So the elements of these groups are maps. It's a question of how you consider these maps. And you can consider them as describing where everything goes, or you describe them as matrices, which is fine, but careful with matrices. Not every map can be described as a matrix.
Well, in space groups, you can do it.
Can you?
Essentially, all symmetry operations are like 3 cross 3 matrices.
How do you describe a translation with a matrix? That's the thing. So now you run into problems. So now you have to think about how do I want to represent my maps, and do I find a language that works for all of them, or do I run into limitations and then I have to maybe split off a part and describe it differently? And all that, I'm not saying that you cannot just keep all this language and all this intuition in your mind, but some of this, to my feeling, is just not precise enough. So sometimes when I ask people what they mean exactly, they are not able to tell me. And then I think there is a problem. So maybe this can help you to sort of bridge this little gap between your intuition and a proper description of what it actually is. That would be great, because the perfect situation would be that you are still able to use your intuition, but that some of the words now could be described more precisely if someone asked you.
In physics, usually these elements are represented by like a tuple of or a pair of a matrix and a vector.
Yeah.
And the vector part is the translation, and the matrix would be the point group. And
yes.
Like the reflection, rotation.
Yes, and again, the matrix is not the point group. The matrix represents an element from a point stabilizer. So this, again, it's just, I understand what you mean, it's an oversimplification, and within a particular community, it's fine to use the simplification. The things I talk about, they occur when people from different areas try to communicate with each other. So very often this has happened to me, in particular when I talk to people from chemistry or physics, or sometimes computer science, that they were describing a situation to me, they were using all these words, I had no idea what they were talking about, and then we drew a picture, and they started to explain, and maybe the words they used meant something different for me, but at least at some point I was able to understand what they meant, and then I could use my language, and at some point we could match it. So that was what happened. And then we could find something that was precise enough for me, so that my mathematical goblins in my head do not go completely crazy, but it was still close enough to their intuition, so they were able to keep talking and to tell me their ideas. So that's the goal. The goal is not to leave your community and to always use these other words. The goal is to be able to talk to more people from other disciplines, I think.
Yeah, that's cool.
Hopefully. Yeah. Let's see. It's quite ambitious, but I think we have already gone quite a way today. And the ideas that come from you show me that we are going somewhere, and that somehow we are connecting dots, which is good. More comments or ideas or questions?
In my field, I hear this term called Z2 topological invariant, and this Z2 term comes from group theory.
Z2?
Yeah.
I know the notation Z2, but in different ways. Is it this?
Yes.
So very often this is an abbreviation for this. So this is a factor group. So Z is a group with plus 2z is all the even integers, and then we can look at the factor root, and this root only has two elements. Because you either look at all the odd numbers together or all the even numbers together. So this is a group that has two elements.
Yeah.
And Z2 is often taken as an abbreviation for any group that has just two elements.
Okay.
So typically, it would be the identity map and the reflection.
Okay.
That together would be a group of two elements. So often this is what people mean. Yeah. Right. Should we slowly come to an end? What do you think? Are you ready to slowly come to an end? We are quite a bit earlier than I thought, but this, to me, it feels like a natural ending point or transversion. Transition. Thank you. Transition point, which means that now that I have taken the remaining questions and comments, I will stop the audio, and we will discuss where you can access the audio and how we are going to design tomorrow. Right.